Let's get started with a review. Okay, so last time we introduced the Boltzmann equation, which was our evolution equation for the distribution function, which is going to define for us, for some set of species, some ensemble of particles of some species I, how the distribution function in phase space evolves in the presence of interactions. Okay, when the right-hand side was zero, that was the so-called collisionless Boltzmann equation. As a brief little aside, we discussed the definition of momentum in phase space and how that related to the derivative of the position four vector with respect to the affine parameter, and then there was some confusion about exactly where the a's go. So we're just going to define the magnitude of the momentum as the spatial part of the metric times the position four velocity, where we could see that here we would get a factor of a squared. Okay. And then this is the thing that we called p before. And with this definition, everything should be okay. So sorry for the confusion. Okay. All right, so there's the Boltzmann equation, and then last time we integrated the Boltzmann equation to get the following. And I still couldn't track down that darn factor of two. And Ian, I tried your suggestion, but that wasn't it. Sorry. So still, ransom is out for the factor of two. You'll be handsomely rewarded. Okay, but anyway, assuming we can get there, then one of the things that I don't remember if I said or not, is that in the absence of any interactions, so when there's no collisional term on the right-hand side of the Boltzmann equation, then this implies that the number density just falls off like 1 over a cubed. Okay? So in the absence of interactions, the consequence of the Boltzmann equation is just that the number density of particles dilutes with the expansion of the universe. And that's it, right? Which kind of makes physical sense. So the number density goes like 1 over a cubed if the collisional term is 0. Okay, so in the absence of any interactions. And then we started to talk about equilibrium distribution functions and then different things we can compute with those equilibrium distribution functions. So let's finish that discussion. So if you have frequent interactions, meaning that you're in thermal equilibrium, or sometimes called kinetic equilibrium, then the distribution function will tend to the following. Where we get a minus sign for bosons and then a plus sign for fermions. G was the degeneracy factor, so that counts like the number of spin states. So 2 for the photon, 2 for a Dirac spinner, so on and so forth. Mu was the chemical potential, T was the temperature, E was the energy. We also showed that in the absence of interactions, that the collisionless Boltzmann equation in an expanding universe preserves the form of the distribution function, but it just makes the temperature depend on time or the scale factor. Okay, so that means that once you establish this distribution, if you take away interactions, then you maintain this distribution. So that was another thing we talked about. And then we talked about various integrals of this equilibrium distribution function and how they can define for us the number density of particles, the energy density of particles, and so on and so forth. So let's just remind ourselves of that. So for example, the number density is just the integral over a momentum space of the distribution function. So if we imagine that we forget about the chemical potential and we just look in chemical equilibrium, then this gave us that, where E is a function of P. And then, of course, one special case is where we have relativistic particles where E was equal to P. And so in that case, we get something that we can integrate. So that's just e to the p over t plus or minus 1. You can integrate over the angular directions in p. That gives you a 4 pi. And then you get a p squared, magnitude of p squared. And then you can integrate this, the result being g, the Riemann zeta function evaluated at 3, which is like 1.2. I just wrote the number last time, but that's that. Pi squared t cubed. And I couldn't remember what you get for fermions versus bosons. You multiply this 1 for bosons, and you multiply this by 3/4 for fermions. So you can evaluate the number density exactly for the relativistic case. We can also do it for the non-relativistic case. Okay, so in the non-relativistic case, E is just m plus p squared over 2m. And if we're non-relativistic, it's probably the case that the temperature is way less than m. So that's another thing we can use. So T is much less than m. And in this case, the number density was just this degeneracy factor, d cubed p over 2 pi cubed. And we could expand the distribution function because this exponential is really big because t is really small, so that we got e to the minus m over t and then an e to the minus p squared over 2mt. And then again, that's an integral that we can do. And we got the degeneracy factor mass times temperature over 2 pi to the 3 halves power times e to the minus m over t. Okay. All right, so that was all stuff we did last time. Yeah, there's a few other tricks we can play with the equilibrium distribution function that I want to talk about before we go on to talk about things that are out of equilibrium. So in addition to the number density, we could calculate the energy density. So the energy density is just an integrate the distribution function weighted by the energy. If we focus on relativistic particles, then we can evaluate this exactly too. So I just want to collect a few results because we're going to use them in a minute. So we get some nice, beautiful pies and integers. If we just plow through these integrals, we could define the pressure. The pressure is again a weighted integral. So this is E. P squared over 3e times the distribution function. E is just p, so that's a p. P squared over p is just p. So this looks just like the energy density, but with a factor of a third. So that's just rho over 3. Recall that for perfect fluids, we describe p as some constant times rho. And so in this case, for relativistic particles, which is what we call radiation, we see that w is a third, kind of as we expected. Okay. We could see that for massive particles, we would also get something similar, because this was p squared over 3 E. For massive particles, E is like m. We get p squared over m. M is way bigger than p squared, and so pressure is nearly zero. Yeah, so for non-relativistic matter, p is zero, w is zero. And that makes sense with that definition as well, just so you know that. Just a little aside. Okay, and finally, the last density we can define is the entropy density. That's dp dt, which we can write as rho plus p. And if we generalize to have a non-zero chemical potential, then that's going to appear in here too. Divided by T. Okay, so if we set mu to 0, and we did this integral, well, P is just rho over 3. So this should then just be 4 thirds times rho. Okay? So for relativistic particles, it's easy to evaluate what the entropy density is. And the entropy density is an interesting and important quantity because you can prove, which I will not do here, that if I take the time derivative of the entropy density, And I use what I know from the Boltzmann equation about how number densities evolve. You can show that this relation is true here. Okay. If you look in the notes, there's a short derivation of how that goes. Okay. But this is really important because it implies a few things. So first of all, this guy here is proportional to this integral over the collisional term from the Boltzmann equation. So if we look at the integrated form of the Boltzmann equation on the right-hand side. So in the absence of interactions, then the entropy density is conserved. So that's one powerful use of this. Well, the entropy density times A cubed is conserved. So that's one powerful thing that comes out of this. The other thing is that if we are in chemical equilibrium, in other words, if the chemical potential is zero, then it's also true that the entropy density is conserved in this sense. Okay. So for mu equals zero slash in the absence of interactions, then the entropy density for any species is going to be proportional to 1 over A cubed. It's also true that the number density is proportional to 1 over A cubed. And so then that implies that the entropy density over the number density will just be a constant for all times. Okay. Well, not for all times, but it's, yeah, sure, it's constant. Yeah, so here we could figure out, at least in this example, what the constant is. So if the entropy density for relativistic particles, it's 4/3 rho. We know what rho is here. We know what the number density is up there. And so you can see it's just going to be a bunch of integers and pi's and stuff, right? Okay, this is a particularly powerful statement too, because you can see that in these distribution functions, everywhere there appear, everywhere in these distributions there appear these numbers of degrees of freedom, right? And so at different times in the universe, there will be different numbers of relativistic degrees of freedom. And from this conservation of entropy, if things, you know, become slow enough that they become non-relativistic, we'll change the number of relativistic degrees of freedom. But if, as long as nothing is interacting, that's okay. We can figure out what happens to the entropy density even under the change in the number of degrees of freedom. That'll be important for your tutorial today. Just to say that. Okay, so this property can be useful. Makes physical sense too. Like, you know, how do you create entropy? You need interactions. You need to do something. Like, you can't just sit here. That won't do anything. So unless you change the state by having interactions, then you don't create entropy. Okay, another thing we can look at while we're at it and we're considering these equilibrium properties is the ratio of the number of baryons in our universe to the number of photons, which turns out to be an extremely important number. So So the baryon to photon ratio. So the CMB is this gas of photons that is now permeating our universe. We measure the spectrum of the CMB, and it looks like a perfect blackbody spectrum, and so we can measure the temperature. And if I have a gas of photons, the CMB doesn't interact with anything. It used to be in thermal equilibrium, so it just has the blackbody or Bose-Einstein distribution function, and therefore the blackbody dependence of the spectrum is a black body. So we can use this result up here for the number density. And it's just a gas of non-interacting photons, and then the temperature evolves with the scale factor. Okay, so the number density of CMB photons, just transcribing what we have up there, is 2 times this 1.2 basically, times the temperature cubed. The temperature of the CMB is 2.725 degrees Kelvin. We can convert everything into EV, and we get something like 3.15 times 10 to the minus 12 EV cubed. And since it's a number density, maybe it makes more sense to think about it in terms of numbers per meter cubed, which might be a little bit more physical pedestrian set of units. Okay, okay, so that's the number of CMB photons in a cubic meter, and it's pretty enormous. Recall at some point we talked about the baryonic matter and the critical density. So if we just had matter in the universe, the critical density is like a few protons per cubic meter. So right off the bat, you could see that the few protons per cubic meter at most that I can have without making the universe recollapse is way tinier than the number of photons that we can have. Okay, so we could compute the number density of baryons just a little bit more precisely. It's rho baryon over the mass of a proton, because to leading order, most baryonic matter in the universe is protons. Okay, so we got to just knock this critical density down by a factor of omega baryon. That's like 0.05. And this ends up being about 0.22 per meter cubed. Okay. And so if we compute the baryon to photon ratio, just the number density of baryons today over the number density of photons today, we get like 5 times 10 to the minus 10. Okay. So if we're just counting, there are way more photons than baryons by a factor of a billion. And that is intimately related to another observational property of our universe, is that we're all made of matter. It's not that some of us are made of matter and others of us are made of antimatter. Okay, so there is this asymmetry between matter and antimatter. And that is reflected here by the fact that this has to actually be a pretty small asymmetry. Because I know that I can take baryons and antibaryons and turn them into 2 photons. In the early universe, this process would happen. It would happen both forwards. It would happen in reverse. I can have 2 photons have enough energy that they can make a baryon-antibaryon pair. But eventually, when things get cold enough, when the temperature goes below the mass of these baryons, then things don't go in this direction anymore. And the baryons will find the antibaryons and annihilate into photons, right? So the fact that this is not zero, right? In other words, that the only thing in the universe is not photons is reflected in the fact that there must have been a little bit of a difference in the number of baryons and the number of antibaryons. Okay. So it's not zero, so that means that the number density of baryons cannot be equal to the number of antibaryons. But eta is small. So the number densities were nearly equal, just not exactly. Okay, question?
What if we calculated the baryon number density using the formula that we have for non-relativistic particles?
Excellent, yeah. You find this statement to be true. So you could solve for what is the initial difference in number densities that's required to get this number. Yeah, so that's a great exercise that you could do. Assume that the universe is only made of, say, electrons and positrons. Because those were the last things, because the electron is the lightest particle in the Standard Model, those were the last things to go out of equilibrium here. And then you could just ask, given some initial number density of electrons and some initial number density of positrons, solve the Boltzmann equation in the way that we'll learn how to solve it in 10 or 15 minutes. And then out will pop an answer for the final number densities once this interaction stops going in the reverse direction. Yeah.
Actually, I think I had a slightly different question.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So I was wondering that the calculation that we did of the ratio of NC and B over NB,
yep.
We calculated NB by using the more critical value that, like, the input for that was the Einstein equations.
Uh-huh.
Whereas here we also have a method for computing number densities using the Boltzmann. So I was wondering what if we use the Boltzmann equation.
You would get exactly the same answer as you had gotten using the Einstein equations. Yeah. Because the whole content then would have just been that the number density dilutes like 1 over a cubed.
Okay.
Because baryons, let's say, are not interacting, mm-hmm. right? Or not meaningfully interacting with anything right now. So then they just dilute like 1 over a cubed.
Okay.
That's basically this. Any other questions? That's okay. So this baryon to photon ratio will come back kind of again and again, and have some interesting and important consequences for BBN, for example. Okay. So that's kind of all I wanted to say about equilibrium stuff, and now we can move on to talk about non-equilibrium stuff, so actually contend with solving the Boltzmann equation. So let's consider a generic process where I have four different species, and I have an interaction where species one can interact with species two to give me species three and species four, and then this interaction can also work in reverse, so three and four can act to give me one and two. Okay. So we can write down sort of generic form for the Boltzmann equations. There will be four equations. Let me just write down one of them. Okay, so there's the left-hand side. And then there's the right-hand side with that collisional term. So let me just write down a bunch of definitions. And then we'll see how that relates back to this term in a second. So I'm going to write, this is the number density of species one in equilibrium. Okay, so if species one is a non-relativistic particle, we're going to use that equation up there on the bottom. And if species one is relativistic, we'll use the one just above it. Okay, this is the interaction rate. We're going to define gamma. As something, so it's just definition, called the thermally averaged cross section. Times the equilibrium density for N2. Okay. So this is the cross section for particle one scattering on particle two to do something interesting. And so the rate of that interaction is going to be the cross section times the velocity times the density of this thing we're interacting with, N2. Okay, and then we have a factor that counts the relative number of particles. Okay, so if I have some three and four around, then they can interact to give me more one. Okay, so that's what this term is telling us. It's positive, so this would cause dn1 dt to go up. And then if I have n1 and n2 around, they can interact to give me n3 and n4. So that will take away from my population of n1. Okay. And the rate at which this happens depends on how far away from equilibrium I am. Okay? So the further I am away from equilibrium, the faster I will create more N1 particles if I have N3 and N4 around, and the faster I'll get rid of N1 particles if those species are out of equilibrium. Okay. So this thermally averaged cross section is going to relate us back to the integral that we have up there. So that's where the integral went. So the definition of this thermally averaged cross section okay, so we divide by N1, N2. So that would remove this and this. So you can see those are there just from this definition. Okay, and then here we've got the first integral, which is over all the momenta for particle one, and that corresponds to the integral that's up there in the Boltzmann equation. Times that collisional term, which has to do with the integrals, basically the, so this is like a total cross section. So we have to integrate over all the phase space of particles two, three, and four. So, so we have all of these integrals over the phase space for particles two, three, and four. there's a factor that comes in, which is why we say it's thermally averaged. So there's this Boltzmann factor. Then there are some terms that force us to conserve momentum. So there's a delta function. For momentum, there's a delta function for energy. So just as usual in some special relativistic calculation, right? We've got the three momentum four vector, well, the momentum four vector on the left had better equal the momentum four vector on the right. So energy and momentum have to be conserved. So that's the three momentum conservation. That's the energy conservation on the left and right. And then we multiply by the thing that has all the physics in it, which is the matrix element squared. So most of this, besides this factor and these factors here, should look just like cross-section, total cross-section. This factor and this are what we mean by thermally averaged, because I weight in the integral by the Boltzmann factor with the energy, and then I divide out what I would have gotten in equilibrium. Okay, so kind of schematically, that's what goes into this term here. All right, actually, let's go back here. Let me just rearrange this equation ever so slightly. So let's just divide out by this 1 over n1. Okay. So on the left-hand side of this equation, we basically got 1 over delta t. Let's say we're reasonably close to equilibrium, so n1, 0, equilibrium is of order n1. Okay, and we got a cubed n1 over a cubed n1 dt. Okay, so this left-hand side is basically saying on what time scale, what is the time scale over which this distribution can change? Okay, and for an expanding universe, sort of natural time scale over here is going to be Hubble. So we can choose to measure time in terms of Hubble. And we'll call it fast interaction, one that happens on a time scale far faster than 1 over h. And interaction that is slow is one that happens far slower than 1 over h. Okay. So we could take this equation and let's just divide both sides by Hubble. So that's not really doing anything. It's just defining for me a meaningful interval of time. Okay? And so we can see that what we really would like to do is then to figure out what happens, compare on the right-hand side this interaction rate to Hubble. Okay? And there's two interesting regimes. So if the interaction rate is far faster than Hubble, then I've got a big number multiplying the thing in parentheses equals a number of order one. So that means that the thing in parentheses had better be really small to maintain that equality. And so in this regime, more or less, we want to solve for the equilibrium distribution in the number density of particles of each of these four species. So that's called the Saha equation, okay? On the other hand, if we go to the opposite regime, where gamma is much less than Hubble, yeah, question?
Why in the first condition, in the first case, that the left-hand side is small?
Oh, the left-hand side is order one, because we're saying that it changes the distribution function in an expanding universe is going to change on time scales set by the expansion, so of order Hubble. Yeah. In other words, so Hubble, the expansion of the universe is causing these particles to dilute, right? If I want my interactions to do something meaningful to the number densities, I better do something on a time scale faster than I'm diluting the particles, right? And that time scale on which I'm diluting the particles is set by 1 over h. So whatever processes I'm doing, whatever interactions there are, they're really not going to compete with the expansion unless they happen on that time scale. They happen faster, they'll compete with the expansion. If they happen slower, they then forget about it. Doesn't matter.
So when they are faster, I mean, the first case, they're faster than the expansion, right? So in the left-hand side, they are mainly contributed by the interaction instead of the expansion.
Yeah, exactly. So
why we call it order h or order one? We don't know the change.
Well, so if I would like something to happen to my distributions, then and I'd like them to happen on a time scale that is roughly comparable with the expansion time scale. Okay.
Why we do need that? So can we have one? I mean, if we only have 1, 2, and no 3, 4,
yep.
Then that can be happen, and then the process can happen in very small time.
Mm-hmm.
So that both the left hand side and right hand side are very big. I mean, the
mm-hmm.
initially we only have n1, 0. I mean, initially n3, 0, n4, 0 are zero.
Mm-hmm.
So only we have n1, 0, n2, 0, and then the n1 exponential decay.
Yep.
So can
yeah, and that will happen until you get to the point where you built up an appreciable population of n3 and n4.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And then. What's going to happen is that on the right-hand side, if the interaction rate is still huge, let's say, yeah, the right-hand side is, the thing in parentheses is now getting smaller. Let me say it, maybe I could say it a slightly different way. So let's do a quick exercise and see if this goes anywhere. But bear with me for just a second. So let's say that N1, this is not going to work. Maybe this will work. OK, so let's say that N1 is some function of the scale factor.
Yes.
Yeah. And then let's try and expand out the left-hand side. I'm not really going to do anything terribly complicated, I guess, here. So we've got this. And let's just change variables from A to T. And then we had an h here, right? Okay, so h is dA dt over a. So we'll get a squared, and then we'll get rid of that. I haven't done anything yet, actually. So n1, 0, a squared, dA cubed, and one dA. So now let's expand this guy out. So we get two terms. The first one we're going to get is the one where I act on N1, and then the A's the I get an A.
Yes.
Right? So we'll get a...
No A, A squared cancel. Oh, A, yes.
A cubed, right? So A cubed over A squared gives me an A. Okay, so we get that. And then we get another term where we get the A squareds to knock out, right? That, I think, right? Okay, good. So, right. I guess I shouldn't put that there, right? Okay, so if A is changing on a scale that's relevant for the scale factor, right, then, well, this is the one that's telling us about the change. And then we've got this other guy that comes along for the ride. So let's just consider this one for now, okay? And let's say that this is now order N1 over N1 equilibrium. So I have over here this thing that tells me I've got, let's just write it. So we've got this, and we're saying that this should be comparable to gamma over H, and then that multiplies this thing in parentheses. So now let's go back to your example. So you wanted to say, well, what if I start with just N1 and N2, right? Then I've got something that goes like N1 times N2 times a really big number is supposed to equal something that's of order N1 over N2. So I can't do that, right? Some sense. In order to maintain this,
N1 is approximately equal to N1 zero, that we're not too far away from equilibrium.
Well, it doesn't matter, because over here I've got something that we're gonna say is that appears in here, right?
Yes, but also N2 zero.
Yep. That's right.
N2 over N2 zero is very small to make that.
Yes, okay. So that is a logical possibility, but another logical possibility is that the difference between these terms is also really small.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Why did we neglect del N1 over del A?
Why did we do what, sorry?
Why did we neglect dN1 over dA? Or how did we write that expression is like N1 over N1 zero?
Yeah, so we neglected this because we were just going to say, I don't want my densities to be changing on time scales that are way, way faster than the scale set by expansion, right? But in the scenario that you were suggesting, that would have been silly to neglect this term too, right? Because actually, if I had a big out of equilibrium distribution of N1, then it would probably want to change really quickly, right? And so then this term would not really be negligible. That's right. There's also the boneheaded thing to do, which would be just put in some initial conditions for this set of four differential equations and see how they behave in these different regimes. Okay? And if you're not too far from equilibrium to begin with in your initial conditions, or we don't dream up some really special scenario, then you'll just find that this is the case. Yeah. That will be a good approximation. Okay, on the other hand, if gamma over H is really tiny, then that implies that the left-hand side is approximately zero, right? So that implies we go back to this collisionless regime, in which case the number densities are just conserved. Okay, so these two regimes are very useful because they tell us that we can approximate solutions to the Boltzmann equations in the following way. We figure out where the interaction rate is bigger than Hubble, solve the Saha equation, when gamma is less than Hubble, A cubed times the number densities is a constant. Okay, so that's a reasonable approximation. Okay, so we just need to solve the Saha equation until gamma equals h. We figure out the time at which that happens, and then forever after that time, the solution is a constant. So when this happens, when gamma equals h, it's called freeze out. And you can think, roughly speaking, that's when the interactions are no longer frequent enough to cause the distribution to function to change on timescales that are meaningful when compared to the expansion. They're going to happen slower than that. Okay, so we'll do this three times. And you can do it n times and make a career out of it. If you want to dream up weird dark matter models or something, like pretty much what you do. Infinite fun. We'll do it once a day in lecture for BBN. You'll do it once later in tutorial, where you'll look at the thermal production of dark matter. And then probably we'll have to wait until next Tuesday to do it the third time when we'll talk about the CMB, the formation of the CMB. I don't think I'll get there today. Okay, so let's talk about Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So if we go again to our like ranking of temperature or energy and the relevant physics at different temperatures or different energies, time goes the opposite way. At late times, we saw before, the universe was matter dominated. At early times, eventually the radiation component wins, and we get a universe that is radiation dominated. So in this case, h squared is proportional to the energy density in radiation. And if we look up there, right there, we'll remember that the energy density in radiation goes like t to the fourth power. Okay. So as we go back during radiation domination, Hubble gets big, t gets big, as we go back further in time. we flip back to what we did a while back and solve the Friedman equation for radiation domination, the scale factor goes like t to the minus 1/2 power, okay? And if we work out how, if I have standard model particles, the temperature depends on time, the temperature is about an MeV when t equals 1 second. And then temperature grows like 1/T to the 1/2. OK, so at some point, we get to an MeV. That's at a time of like a second. Okay. Before that, some of the other relevant timescales we had were 100 MeV. Okay, so 100 MeV is like 10 milliseconds. Okay, and MeV is like 1 second. And then we could go all the way up to M Planck. The standard model is good up until M Planck. We could calculate the time at which that happens. So I don't know, let's do that. This will probably be a miserable failure because I didn't prepare in advance, but let's see if we can work with real numbers. So yeah, here we'd have like 10 to the 18 giga electron volts. So that's 10 to the 21 MeV, okay, over an MeV should equal 1 second over T to the 1/2. So T is like, what, 10 to the minus 41 or 2 seconds? And that's like the Planck time. So that worked out, right? Okay, so at this point, big question marks. We come down in energy a little bit as the universe grows and expands. This is when quarks and gluons go to neutrons and protons. And then here at an MeV, there's actually a lot of interesting things happening. So, so at these energies, generally speaking, we cannot yet form atomic nuclei, as we'll discuss in a second. So we've got a bunch of neutrons and protons. There's a lot of neutrinos. Yeah, there's electrons. The energy of an MeV, the rest mass of the electron, is like 500 keV. So at around this time, we can still have electrons and positrons annihilating to photons and photons air-producing electrons and positrons. So lots of interesting things happening around an MeV. But in particular, around this time, or a little bit after this time, neutrons and protons can form atomic nuclei. And the description of that process is Big Bang nucleosynthesis. We'll do one of the things that happens here, but for example, we could do the other interesting thing, which is like given electrons and positrons annihilating photons, we could do the calculation that you wanted to do. I encourage you to do. Now you know how to do it. Okay, so we could talk about nuclear physics just briefly. So an atomic nucleus, well, got protons, let's say there are z of them, and neutrons, let's say are there n of them. And we can define the atomic mass as just the total of number of nucleons in a nuclei. Okay. Why do we have atomic nuclei? Because they're bound states of nucleons. And so we can define a binding energy. Let's call it B, which is the sum of the mass of all the protons and neutrons in our nucleus minus the mass of the nucleus. Okay. So if it really is a bound state, there better be a difference, right? The bound state had better be a little bit lighter than its constituents, a little bit lower energy, otherwise it wouldn't have formed, wouldn't be a bound state. Okay, so that's the binding energy. Hey, another interesting fact, if we think about the masses of the neutrons and protons, the proton is just ever so lightly, ever so slightly less massive than the neutron. Okay, so m neutron minus m proton is like 1.29. MeV, if I wrote those numbers down right, okay? So there's about an MeV difference. It's like a 1% difference between the masses, a little bit less than a percent, actually. And this has important consequences because it means that neutrons can decay into a proton, an electron, and a neutrino, okay? So if it were the opposite, then protons would be unstable, and there would be no hydrogen atoms, okay? So it's a good thing that it's like this. And the lifetime of a neutron is like 890 seconds, okay? So minutes. Okay, so we could look at the different atomic numbers. So 1 is hydrogen, okay? Just a reminder, element, isotope, so that's how many nucleons are in there. 2 is deuterium, okay? And then so on and so forth. We can have A equals 3, that's helium 3 or tritium, helium 4, and so on and so forth. But more or less, the thing that we need is to ask, okay, so if I take a nucleus and I start shoving more nucleons into it, does it get more bound or less bound? Because if it gets more bound and I shove a nucleon into a nucleus, then I can get energy out. That's called fusion. If it's less bound, then I get, well, I have to put energy in, right? Or if I break a nucleus apart, I get energy out. That's called fission. And so that makes it interesting to look at the binding energy per A, per nucleon, as a function of A, how many nucleons. And this, more or less, looks something like this, where the peak is around 56, and that's iron. So if we had a universe that didn't do anything, it was just really hot, and it stayed really hot forever, then the only atom that we would form would be iron, right? Because we would have a hot universe. I can always get energy from this system by combining nucleons to make atomic nuclei until I get to iron, and then it would just stop, right? And this is what happens inside of stars. So in the core of stars, they burn elements to heavier and heavier elements until we get to iron, and then they stop, and then they blow up in a supernova. However, the universe did not stay the same for all times. It evolves, and that leads to really interesting dynamics. And it makes it so that most of the stuff in the universe is not iron, it's actually helium and hydrogen. So there's an interesting feature that we need to add to this plot, which is the following. So there's a peak here that happens at A equals 4 for helium-4. Turns out that helium-4 is a really tightly bound nucleus. It makes it very costly to go past A equals 4, because I have to put energy in if I want to get up the ladder in A. And so more or less, because of this, so there's a few like coincidences. I'll just tell you the punchline. So there's this mass difference. Okay, this small mass difference, but there is a difference, and that's very important. There's the fact that the baryon to photon ratio is such a tiny number, so that once I start making nuclei, they can get quickly blown apart by photons. And because there's so many more photons than nuclei, that hurts a lot. And then there's the fact that helium-4 is tightly bound. And it also turns out that there is no A equals 5 or A equals 8. There's just no bound nuclei for these atomic numbers. And all of this conspires, all of these coincidences kind of come together to give us a universe that really only has, in the order of their importance, hydrogen, helium-4, deuterium, tiny little bit of tritium, tiny little bit of lithium, tiny little bit of beryllium, and like nothing else. That's it. Okay. So if we play with these things, as I've encouraged you to try to play with some of them in the homework, then you'll get different outcomes for nucleosynthesis. But because of these coincidences, more or less, this is all we'll end up with at the end of BBM. Okay, so now let's see how that actually happens. So there's kind of a nice chain of events that happens during BBN. So the first thing that happens is that there are interactions between neutrons and neutrinos that can give us a proton and an electron, or neutrons and positrons that can give us protons and a neutrino. And so these interactions will change the relative number of protons and neutrons, okay? But eventually, because you could see that this has neutrinos in it, the cross-section is set by the weak cross-section scale, and the weak cross-section is called weak. Well, the weak force is called weak because it's weak. And so this will kind of go out of equilibrium. In other words, it will freeze out at some point when gamma equals H, kind of at the beginning of the game, right? And then a few of these coincidences come in. So I make neutrons and protons, but the neutrons are going to be pretty stable, stable enough, because at an MeV, we're talking about t equals 1 second. And the lifetime of a neutron is like 890 seconds. So during this little hiatus, my neutrons, for the most part, don't decay away. Right? If the decay time was way faster, they'd just be gone as soon as this reaction stopped. Okay? But they stick around. And the other coincidence that leads to a little hiatus here is this fact that the baryon to photon ratio is so tiny. So I start to make atomic nuclei, but then they're just quickly broken apart by photons. So I need to wait a little bit. OK, but then eventually, we can get the first bound states of nuclei, of nucleons, which is deuterium, atomic number 2. So that's just a proton and a neutron can give me deuterium plus a little bit of extra energy in the form of a photon. So I make some deuterium. And then once I make deuterium, it turns out to be relatively easy to springboard to helium. Okay. So first we get helium-3 and tritium. And then from here, we can get to helium-4. And we really want to get to here because the binding energy is so big for helium-4. Okay. And then after this, things pretty much stop. Like, we make a bunch of helium-4, and then the rates are really slow. And then things stop interacting. And we're kind of left with this plus tiny trace amounts of the other stuff. Okay. So what we can do is first figure out what is the number of neutrons and protons I have at my disposal, then figure out how much deuterium I can make with that many neutrons and protons, and then figure out how much helium and 4 I can make with that much deuterium. And that's the three steps. So let's do the first one. Okay, so the reaction we're considering is we have a neutron and a lepton, so either a neutrino or positron. And that can give me a proton plus another lepton. Call it lepton 1 and lepton 2. Okay. So neutrinos and positrons. Well, first of all, the positrons and the electrons, there's also a bunch of photons hanging out, and they like to interact a lot with photons. So more or less, we can assume that the electrons and positrons are in thermal equilibrium with that huge bath of photons. And because there are so many more photons than there are baryons, these interactions don't do anything to the distribution function for electrons and positrons. So they're just in equilibrium. Similarly, for the neutrinos, there are so many more neutrinos than there are baryons. because roughly speaking, there's about as many neutrinos as there are photons. And so these interactions don't really do anything to the distribution function for neutrinos. So we can assume that the leptons are in equilibrium. Furthermore, this is a really fast rate at high temperatures. Okay, so if we go back early enough, when the temperatures are high enough, then in the regime where the interaction rate is way faster than h, we can just try and solve the Saha equation. Okay. That will stop being true at some point when these things freeze out. So we can start by solving the Saha equation. And in this case, the Saha equation is really easy. Because the leptons are in equilibrium, the Saha equation just tells us that the number density of neutrinos compared to their equilibrium distribution is equal to the number of protons divided by their equilibrium distribution. Okay. In other words, if we just want to know what is the ratio of the number of neutrons to the number of protons, then that's just the ratio of their equilibrium distributions with the letters reversed, like that. Okay, so what is that? We can just go back to the definition that we wrote way back when up there for the equilibrium distribution. We have to ask, are these particles relativistic or not? And if we remember that the mass of these particles is like a GeV, and we're talking about temperatures of order in MeV, then yes, they're very much non-relativistic. So we can use that non-relativistic form for the number densities. Okay, so that just gives us the mass of the neutron divided by the mass of the proton to the 3/2 power times e to the minus mass of the neutron minus mass of the proton divided by the temperature. That's just the ratio of those two, where I have mass of the neutron, mass of the proton. Okay. All right, so as a function of time, that's what happens. You can see because the neutron is a little bit heavier than the proton, this is exponentially decreasing, right? So I just get fewer and fewer and fewer neutrons as a function of as the temperature goes down, right? Exponentially fewer. So now we need to figure out what's the freeze-out temperature, because that tells us when to stop solving that equation. We get that for by solving for where gamma is equal to Hubble. Okay. So gamma, that's the number density of neutrinos times this thermally averaged cross section. We can estimate that as G Fermi times T squared. So it's a weak interaction. So we get a G Fermi squared for the cross section. And those scale like energy squared. So we're going to get a T squared. N goes like 1 over A cubed. In other words, T cubed. So this goes like T to the 5th power. And if we stick in units and numbers, we get something that's like 0.048. T over an MeV to the 5th power in inverse seconds. Hubble, on the other hand, well, A goes like T to the minus 1/2 power. We have this expression that we wrote down at some point here for how the time is related to the temperature. And so we can, from that, figure out how Hubble is related to the temperature. So Hubble goes something like temperature over MeV squared inverse seconds. And so we can set these two equal and solve for the temperature. Okay, so this naive estimate gives us like 2 MeV. Turns out that's a little bit too naive. If we're more careful about all the pi's and 2's and everything, we get 0.8 MeV. So that's the temperature at which I should stop applying the Saha equation. And so at freeze out, the ratio of the number of neutrons to the number of protons if we just plug in T freeze, the mass of the neutron and the mass of the proton are about equal, so that prefactor does nothing. You get something like 0.2. Okay. So for every 5 protons, you'll have 1 neutron. So far fewer neutrons than protons, but not like a microscopic amount. So the next thing we do is we get deuterium, but I think in light of the time, I'm going to save that for next time. Where do you guys want to go for 5 more minutes and I'll finish? Yes? Okay. Let's just finish it then. Okay, the next thing we do is make deuterium. So we get a proton and a neutron can go to deuterium plus a photon. Okay. Again, photons, there are tons of them, and so and also they interact with electrons and positrons, so these are in equilibrium. Okay. And I just have to worry about the deuterium, the neutrons, and the protons. This rate is fast compared to Hubble, so we just forget about that. Let's just apply the Saha equation. So the Saha equation tells me this, because photons are in equilibrium, so their distribution functions don't appear on the right-hand side. From this, we can solve for the number density of deuterium over the number density of neutrons times protons. These are all non-relativistic particles. So I just apply again that formula up there for the number density of non-relativistic particles. And at the end of the day, what we end up with is this. So we get mass of deuterium over mass of neutron times mass of proton. But mass of deuterium is like 2 times mass of the neutron. Mass of the proton is like the mass of the neutron. So then we get a power of mass to the neutron. We have t to the 3/2 power over t to the 3/2 power squared. So that's why it appears down here. And the binding energy of deuterium just comes from all those exponentials with different masses in them, right, for the 3 species. So that's just defined as the mass of the proton plus the mass of the neutron minus the mass of deuterium. Okay. We can massage this just a little bit. So we can solve for the number density of deuterium over the number density of neutrons. That is the number density of protons over the number density of baryons, number density of baryons over the number density of photons, and the number density of photons times all that stuff. And so if we calculate what all these things are, so this is order one. This we can calculate from that formula up there, goes like t cubed. And then this is the baryon to photon ratio. Okay. So this roughly goes like the baryon to photon ratio, t to the 3/2 over the mass of the neutron times e to the binding energy of deuterium over t. Okay. So e to the m over t times t over m to the 3/2 times a really ridiculously tiny number. Okay. And we want to know when there is roughly comparable amounts of deuterium to the number of neutrons. So that's what we say, okay, we've made a reasonable amount of deuterium. And you can see that that doesn't happen when the temperature equals the binding energy, because I have to compete with this baryon to photon ratio. That means it takes a little bit longer. Okay. So we can solve for the temperature at which the number density of deuterium equals the number density of neutrons. And that happens at a temperature of 0.07 MeV, if we plug that in. Okay, so that's at like 200 seconds. So at 1 second, I get the neutrons and protons, and then 200 seconds later, I get deuterium. And then basically after this time, all the neutrons get sucked up into deuterium. So they're gone. The last part of the story, now I've got a whole bunch of deuterium, but you can see that because I don't have, for every 5 protons, I have 1 neutron. I've still got some protons lying around. Okay, so I've got protons and deuterium hanging out. And those protons and deuterium can then combine to form helium-3, tritium, and then eventually they form helium-4. So everything, more or less, all of the neutrons that I had after neutron decoupling end up as helium-4. Okay, and we can calculate how much that is. So there's one correction, which is due to the decay rate of the neutron. So some of those neutrons will decay in the meantime in this 199 seconds. And that makes the number of neutrons to the number of protons at the time we form deuterium more like 0.15. That's 6 out of 40, okay? So for every 40 protons, I've got 6 neutrons. And those 6 neutrons end up in helium-4. Helium-4 has got 2 protons and 2 neutrons. So I can make, from this ratio, I can make 3 helium-4s, and I'll have, because I needed to use up 6 protons for that, 34 protons left over. So we can get 3 helium-4 and 34 protons or 34 hydrogens. From 36 nucleons, okay? So that's the soup that we can make, okay? And then from this, we can calculate the ratio of helium to hydrogen. That's a cosmological parameter. It's called Y. I don't know why it's called YP. It's basically the density of helium to the density of hydrogen, of baryons, excuse me. So what fraction of all baryons are helium? So that's 3 heliums times 4 the mass of the proton over A cubed. And then I have 34 protons plus 12 here. I meant to say not 36, but 46. And 12 over 46 is like 0.25, so a quarter. So by density, 25% of baryons are helium. And 75% of baryons are hydrogen. And that's the end. You get 1 deuterium for every million hydrogen. You get 1 tritium for every like 10 million. And you get 1 lithium for every billion or more. Only 1 part per billion up here. Really tiny amounts. Okay, so that is Big Bang nucleosynthesis, the short version. Any questions before take a little break, go do your tutorial? Yep.
Is there any reason why there's no boron or oxygen?
So once we get to helium-4, we have a really long time to wait because the binding energy here for the next element up is actually lower. Okay, so if we were to put things together then, we're competing with not a positive exponent, but a negative exponent. And that makes it really hard. So you just don't go anywhere. You try, but the reaction rates are slow because it's not really energetically favorable for you to do that. So you pretty much stop. Okay? All right, we'll review it on next time and we'll do the CMB. And now you can go solve the Saha equation and freeze out and solve the full Boltzmann equation in all its glory for dark matter. But basically the same thing again for dark matter. All right, see you next week.